Okay, good afternoon. So, before I go on to the actual main subject we're talking about today, some logistic notes. So the return-oriented programming assignment is out. Those of you who have started may have noticed that, yeah, we have a tool which does most of the work of the assignment, meaning that you don't actually have to do something similar to what you did in the exam. That's just how it works. But hopefully you get started on that. I know that some people had Python version technical difficulties, which I'm sorry about. I did not think that that would happen. So they would have changed the instructions if I did. It works. Any questions about the assignment before I move on to other topics? Okay. And another logistical note, we created all but one page of the exam, so that probably will be out later this week. So, up to the time between midterm one and midterm two, we spent a lot of time talking about memory safety and sort of how it can be exploited and various mitigations which try to make it not exploitable. And I'd like to show you, and we'll start it off with a picture from this. This is a survey paper from 2013. SOK stands for systemization of knowledge, something that some parts of the security community like to write papers, review papers like this, which are probably good reading if you want to get introduction to everything that's happening in some subfield. And this is about ways of giving us something like memory safety, all these sorts of mitigations. And this is a table from that paper. So they talk about different ideas we can have for how close we are to our sort of memory safety ideal. And memory safety is like you never use memory you didn't allocate, you never access the wrong object with a pointer that's supposed to go to some array, you never access outside the array. It's all the sorts of things we expect not to happen. And then there's these relaxations of it here, which I'm not going to go into detail, but you can think of them as things like, instead of saying you never go outside the bounds of an array, let's say you go outside the bounds of the array, but only into other data arrays, never to a return address, you know, or another pointer or something like that. That way we split up the memory into things which might contain pointers to code and things which don't. That's an example of some of these approaches. So there's these other approximations, and there's just been a lot of effort on this. And baggy bounds, you see I chose it because it has a nice spot in this table. It does most of what you'd want to do, except it has problems with use after free. It does nothing about that. It has problems with subobjects, meaning that if you have malloc something and it has a buffer and the pointer, you saw that example on our exam, it does nothing about that. But it's about the best solution that existed at this time, and I haven't seen much since then. And it also is pretty good in this compatibility column. So it has a dash, meaning that it just works. And many of these other solutions are a little more conditional. So this thing called softbounds, or softbound plus sets, it says binary compatibility. That means that if you have an existing library that is already compiled for you, and you want to use it with one of those techniques, you're out of luck. You need to recompile the library. With baggy bounds, you don't need to do that. With baggy bounds, we just don't check what happens in the library, but it still works, at least. You can still use it. And that's a common thing that people give up with these solutions. And you can also see on this table many of the things we talked about. So we talked about write X or execute. That's listed as non-executable data. You know, and that's deployed because it's zero overhead. And it has a slight compatibility problem, which is that if you want to compile code at runtime, this is what JIT stands for, just in time, and run it, doesn't work. We have other techniques which have that sort of problem. We have ASLR, which has a problem with relocatable code, but that was surmountable because the overhead wasn't too high. This table claims it's zero, as we discussed. That's probably not quite true, but it's close. And we saw stack cookies, which have no compatibility problems and just work. And there's some other solutions of that sort, which are about protecting either returns or function calls through function pointers in some way, similar in idea to how stack cookies work. And they have various levels of compatibility issues. So you see some of these say you're going to have trouble using a precompiled library with them. You need to recompile everything to use this technique. And you might imagine that's because maybe they're checking every function call and they need something special to happen there, like stack cookies, and then they're changing the calling convention. And we mentioned the shadow stack, and as this table mentions, in addition to being a little slower than stack cookies, that has problems with exceptions, that if you want to do try catch, that has to take the shadow stack into account, and that's extra work. So there's this whole universe, and we're going to talk today about alternatives, but I want to give you the impression that this is an active area of research, and none of the solutions are really great. That there's promise that maybe we can get a really good solution, but it seems like we have a very high cost, especially when you care about compatibility, which is a big issue for deploying. You notice that the things that are deployed here have very few compatibility problems and have very low overhead. So if we are going to make a solution that actually fixes these problems that's deployed, that works, that will just work, it seems like it's a long stretch because it's very hard to imagine us getting but this overhead number down and making it fully compatible with existing libraries that aren't recompiled, or like existing assembly code. Okay. So we're going to talk for next couple days at least about other things we can do besides rely on these mitigations. How else can we deal with these memory errors in software? What are some techniques that you might try to do to, if you're worried about software containing these memory bugs? What would you do? You can't just write it in a way where they, will always crash. So if you're writing a piece of software and you're worried about memory bugs, what are you going to do? This is probably a situation most of you will come across.
Use a tool to check and see if
they're
memory leaks.
So, you'd like to say, one suggestion is use a tool to check and see if they're memory leaks or memory bugs. Yeah. So, maybe there's some tools which can look at our software and say, is there a problem here? And that's a logical approach. So as a software developer, I can take my existing software and maybe I can see, do I have bugs? Maybe I'm not happy with running with the overhead of finding these memory errors in production, but at least I can do it when I'm testing. And if I have a tool which will actually find my memory errors when someone's not exploiting my software and tell me that, you might overflow a buffer here or something like that, that would be useful. So we're going to talk about tools which are focused mostly on this perspective. So there's memory error detectors. So things where you run your software in testing and they will tell you with good precision, are you accessing an array out of bounds? Are you using a freed object? Things like that. And many of these tools are focused not on stopping exploits. So you could use them as a mitigation, but they're not going to be attractive for that. And there's going to be two reasons. So one reason is that if you thought baggy bounds with 60% overhead was bad, these tools are worse, a lot worse. And the other reason is that they won't actually make things not exploitable. They're designed around usually catching the error, not catching the error even when someone's trying to make it not be caught. And we'll see an example of that. And some examples are address sanitizer, which if you've taken 3330 with me, we used in a lab once. Not that people knew what was going on. And Valgrind memcheck. So we're also going to talk about automatic testing tools. So one thing you want to do to software is you want to find out where are my buffer overflows. You'd like to take something where you give it your software and it figures out how can an attacker attack this? What are some inputs which overflow buffers, and that's going to give you the information you as a software developer need to fix it. Also, if you're an attacker, that's the tool you want to use to figure out how do I exploit this software. You don't want to just read through the assembly code and say, oh, there's a buffer here, can I overflow it? You'd rather just have something more automated that tries to do that. So there are tools for doing that. There's also techniques for just analyzing programs more directly. So just like you as a human can read source code and say, can this overflow that buffer? This is something we can have computers do. They aren't great at it, but at least they're more consistent than humans. And they don't have a problem when you give them a million lines of code. So there are tools for that, and we'll talk a little bit about how those might work. And a last solution is, if you're writing new software, we can make programming languages which are better at avoiding these bugs. And you can sort of see that because you all know Java, and in Java, you can't have buffer overflows. Now, Java's made a compromise to do that, but there are things you can do which aren't as much of a compromise, which avoid more memory errors. And things you can do which are, which also avoid memory errors. And they seem like a good idea. Why would I want to write vulnerable software when I could use a language where it's much harder to? Maybe I still do use one of those faster languages, but I only do it for the code which I actually need to be fast. So most of my code is written in a way where I don't have to worry about memory errors. Okay. So any questions about any of this universe here? So I'm going to start out by looking at some of these memory error detectors. I'm going to do it by comparing to what you might do differently than baggy bounds and the things you can actually use. So if you remember when we talked about baggy bounds checking, what they did is they checked pointer manipulation. Whenever you took a pointer and used it to compute a new pointer, like you took a pointer to an array and used it to access some element of the array, they checked, were those two pointers going to the same place? So this is definitely a solution that's reasonable to implement as a compiler modification. But it's not the easiest thing, and wasn't the first thing, and it's the simplest thing to implement. So a more typical solution is instead of checking that the pointer points to the same object, you just check on read and write. Does this pointer point to a valid place? And the difference between this is that here, we're only going to check when we're out of bounds in the middle of nowhere, not in the middle of an object. So if you happen to be lucky and end up in a valid place, we won't notice if you just check reads and writes. That's not acceptable for baggy bounds. But it's more straightforward to implement this strategy. You don't need to track, pointers as they go through the program as much. It's actually easier to implement. So the reason we're going to talk about these solutions, these alternate solutions to baggy bounds, is that you can't use baggy bounds. So it's a published paper. They clearly had a real implementation of it that worked on some version of Windows with some Windows compiler. But you can't really use it as far as I know. But there are alternative tools which you can actually use today that work well, that are supported by your current compiler. But they work slightly differently. They aren't aimed at solving a security problem, they're aimed at being a testing tool. They're going to tell you if you have memory errors that aren't malicious memory errors. They're not going to protect you from malicious people. But they're good for testing because usually in testing, you'll trip this tool if you have a memory bug and you give the right sort of input. So the most usable one is a tool called Address Sanitizer. So this started as a compiler extension for Clang. Since it's been ported to both Clang and GCC, which means every compiler you care about on Linux and OS X, and you can also use it on Windows if you get one of those compilers for Windows. And it's kind of similar to baggy bounds and how it works. So baggy bounds, if you remember, had this big lookup table that for every piece of memory, it said, where does an object start? This giant lookup table. Address Sanitizer works on the same principle. For every byte of memory, it has a big lookup table. It doesn't say where an object starts. It just says, is this memory valid or not? And it just changes memory allocation, including stack allocations, to set this lookup table, just like baggy bounds needs to do that to set this starting point. So that's the similarity to baggy bounds. The difference is that it checks reads and writes. It doesn't check pointer modifications. So this means that it only detects errors that cause you to read or write things between objects. So if you happen to overflow a buffer and go into another object, it's not going to know. Now that doesn't seem very useful the way we usually allocate memory, where we use every byte. So another modification it uses is that it adds space between objects. This is known as a red zone. So it adds space, so there's space between objects for you to accidentally write into. So this will detect most accidental errors, because you'll probably hit that space. But it won't detect some malicious errors where you might be able to skip over that space. So the sort of transformation it does is, let's say you have this array here, and we look it up and we access it using an offset. So if you compile with address sanitizer, the compiler will insert for you something like this. It will look up the address you're about to access before you write it in the table, and if you aren't supposed to write it, it will fail. So, and unlike baggy bounds, this is going to have single byte precision. And it's actually going to have an entry in this table for every single byte of memory. So you'll know if you're off by even one, which doesn't happen with baggy bounds, because for performance, they need to do these extra tricks. Address sanitizer, it's not designed for maximum performance, so it doesn't have that sort of compromise. It's designed to be precise. So, in addition to inserting this extra code, address sanitizer is going to change what the stack looks like. So when it allocates array on the stack, it's going to add some space after the array, called a red zone. And in its lookup table, it's going to have invalid entries for that red zone. And this is how we're going to detect normal buffer overflows. So we're just checking on read and write, but hopefully normal reads and writes will end up here. But this is not suitable if we're worried about malicious adversaries, because a malicious adversary can just set the appropriate index and skip right over the red zone in many cases. So this isn't really designed to protect against malicious adversaries. But it is an effective debugging tool, and it's pretty easy to explain the error when you see it right here if you know what it's next to, which is what address sanitizer will output. It will tell you, oh, you wrote to this red zone here, that was at this index into the array, right after the end. It will tell you that, which is usually enough to figure out what happened. So any questions about this arrangement? So address sanitizer is a tool, if you want to do this, is what I recommend. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I just had a question that I just thought of. With this type of thing, if you know that your problem is coming from a buffer overflow, how would you stop that from happening without using some sort of baggy bounds? How would you stop your code from accepting or allowing that error to fall out?
So the question is, I know I have a buffer overflow somewhere, I want to just stop it. So if you know it's contiguous, address sanitizer actually works. So if you know that that when I overflow the buffer, I'm going to have to access this first thing here before I access this, address sanitizer is perfect. If you don't know that, if your overflow is like this, where the attacker can supply an offset, you're out of luck. They can supply a really, really big offset, probably. Not always, but probably. And that offset could go literally anywhere in memory. So, even something like allocating everything on the heap and having a gigabyte of guard pages around it won't help. So, in general, you need something more like baggy bounds or some other thing which checks pointer arithmetic to deal with that. Yeah. So the question is, How can a pointer change and still point to something valid? So an example here is array at 13. So in this stack layout, that is the return address, which is writable memory. That is valid memory that is allocated. It's not part of this extra red zone, this padding we added to detect buffer overflows. So this would be a case where we wouldn't detect the error. Or if there was something, or if you were writing into this saved RBP, for example, that's something that's legitimately written that we wouldn't detect as an error. Or if there were another array in this function that we could overflow into that and we wouldn't detect it. Yeah.
So this is used for testing, right?
So the question is, this is used for testing, right? Yes. This is intended mainly to help testing.
So you're never going to have a hacker actually trying to do anything with this, because aren't you the only one testing it?
So the question is, you never have a hacker trying to do this. So a reasonable proposal is that since this detects buffer overflows, you could just run it in production. And the only thing really stopping you from doing that, besides that it doesn't protect against some errors, is that it's really slow. It's like 2x slowdown, 2 to 5x slowdown. So probably you don't want to do that on your real system. But you could do it, and it's not unreasonable to do that. If security is a priority for you, to just have this running on your production system, because it will make things crash when more often when they should. But the designers of this tool are not going to tell you, hey, I designed this to work on your production system. They're telling you, this is a debugging tool.
Yes, I know. That's what I was saying. You were saying a hacker could get around this, but you're only trying to check if your code does it by itself, aren't you?
Yeah, so for testing, yeah, this is fine. You don't care about that the hacker could get around it. But I'm just saying a consequence of being a design for testing is that it is actually not suitable as a protection mechanism like baggy bounds would be. That there are relatively common errors it probably doesn't protect against. It would still do something, because if you're only worried about contiguous overflows, it actually stops them at the big performance cost. Okay. So that's address sanitizer. So there's other tools. So I mentioned Valgrind memcheck. And I'm going to mention this mainly because of a cute thing about tools like this. So Valgrind memcheck is very similar to address sanitizer in how it works internally, but it doesn't have any compiler modifications. It works on unmodified binaries, just unmodified programs. And the way it works is that it's a virtual machine, that it changes the move instruction, the move to memory instruction, to check this table before doing the move as part of the virtual machine implementation. There's some limitations with this. So the biggest one is that it can only really reliably detect errors on the heap because it doesn't have these red zones on the stack. For the heap, it replaces the malloc with its own version by just supplying a different C library. And so it can actually detect errors there because it can put some padding between every object on the heap. So this is a tool which actually can detect memory bugs on unmodified programs, and that's a remarkable thing that you can often do for things on the heap where you have malloc and free that you instrument and you don't need to worry about anything else. Everything else is generic, at least. In this case, it's invasive because it's changing every move instruction, but it didn't need to understand the program in any real way. It just needs to know, when I'm moving to memory, is that memory valid or not? Yeah?
What does it use
as its alternate malloc and new implementation to be able to detect that? So the question is, what is this alternate malloc and new implementation? So it's the same, it's the same as any other malloc and new implementation, except it sets up these table entries and also sets up these red zones between heap allocations, not between stack allocations like in this picture, but between heap allocations. So Valgrind just supplies its implementation in place of the C libraries when you try to load a C library as part of its virtual machine. So this means as long as you're dynamically linking the C library, it just it just works as far for detecting buffer overflows and the like on the heap. These techniques also can detect use after free with limitations. So for detecting use after free, your basic technique is you you can detect it a lot of the time is that you just, when someone asks to free something, you provide your own version of free, which marks that region of memory as invalid and waits as long as possible before reusing it. Ideally forever, but you might not always be able to do that. So most of the time you can detect use after free this way, by avoiding reusing addresses. So any questions about any of these testing tools? Yeah.
Will that detect use after free, or just would make sure that you don't?
So it detects use after free, because basically what's going to happen when we would have a use after free is that we will look in this table and it will say invalid. And it will fail. It will crash. And so I've shown you this table as saying valid, invalid. If you actually look at what Address Sanitizer does, it's a little more complicated than that. So it's going to say something like valid or invalid red zone for the stack. And there's another possible thing, which is going to be invalid freed. So it will actually tell you it was used after freed, because it will have this not just invalid, but invalid and freed an entry in the table. So it can give you a diagnosis. And if you ask for the right options, it will also record a stack trace of when it was freed. So it can even tell you invalid and freed, and here was the stack trace where it was freed. Obviously, adding that takes a bit more overhead, but it's definitely worth it for debugging. Yeah?
So since this is like a virtual machine?
So Valgrind is a virtual machine.
Valgrind, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Does that take longer?
So I think Address Sanitizer's like 1.5 to 5x slowdown. Valgrind's probably like 5 to 8. So I think it is a bit slower. The big thing is it has less precision, because it doesn't deal with stack allocations at all. Because you can't add space on the stack. Valgrind can't. But it's a pretty fast virtual machine, because it uses binary translation. Okay, other questions on these? So these are the logical tools for if you know how you're testing your software to figure out, am I doing bad things with memory? Am I overflowing buffers? Which you can't actually tell reliably, because when you overflow a buffer by a little bit, often doesn't do anything. Even when you overflow by a lot, you might get lucky. You might just make the program output subtly wrong output somewhere. These programs, these are things you can actually do as a software developer to make sure that's a real error, so you can find things which are probably security flaws in your software. Now, this still requires you to generate the right inputs. You can detect memory errors, but how do we actually trigger them now that we can reliably detect them in debugging? So there are automatic testing tools for doing this. And there's a reason you need this, which is if you think about what we've done in assignments, our typical security exploits use these crazy inputs you would never actually generate if you're testing software for correctness. You probably wouldn't try a 8,000 plus character name when you're testing software, but you clearly needed that for the overflow assignment, for example. And also, of course, now at least we have memory errors crashing, but we still need to generate these tests which trigger these weird cases. And we could try doing this by hand, and that's a reasonable strategy, but there's automated tools for doing it. And there's this remarkably simple strategy for doing automatic testing to find these sorts of bugs, which has been very successful despite being very simple, and that's just generate random inputs. Just generate tons of random inputs. It's called fuzzing. This will get you all your weird inputs, and you just try several billion of these. You just use all the computers you have lying around, rather than run for a couple days, and you'll maybe, and you see if it crashes. And if it crashes, then you know that you probably have something you need to look at. And this is one of the most common ways in the real world to find security bugs. That you just generate random inputs, try running the program, see if it triggers a crash. Ideally, you do something like these memory error detectors so you can reliably detect if you overflow a buffer or something like that, but you don't even need to do that because some amount of the time they'll segfault. Like you overflow a buffer into return address, usually segfaults. So a normal procedure for this is that you start off with a correct input and you just make some random changes to it. So an example way you might do this is here's some C++ code, and let's say we have an image parser. So I want to fuzz test this image parser. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a test image, make a test image, where I'm going to start with some original correct image that the parser works on. Then I'm just going to flip some random bits in the image. And then I'm going to see if the image parser crashes. So this is one way I can do this sort of random testing. And this sort of strategy has found bugs in real image parsers and real video parsers, where the image or video parser just, you know, when you set some fields in the image or video to some invalid values by flipping them randomly, it ends up crashing. And then you look at that crash and you figure out, oh, it turns out that this crash is a buffer overflow or something like that, because that was a size field, for example, that wasn't checked. This is a way people have found security bugs. And you can imagine all sorts of variants to the strategy. So here I'm just flipping some random bits. You can imagine adding bytes or removing bytes or making other random changes. So this is a really attractive strategy. The biggest thing is that it works with completely unmodified software. I didn't need to know anything about the image parser to do this. I just needed to be able to run it. I didn't need to look at it. I didn't even need to understand what the image parser was like. I just needed to have an example valid image to start with, so my inputs were kind of close. And it's really easy to parallelize. So if I have a pile of machines lying around, say on Google, I can just do lots of this, and I'll get some more benefit from the extra machines I devote to it. It's not like manual like testing where I have to devote human effort to get each test case out. So the disadvantage is that we're using unmodified software. We are not looking inside the software. So there's some limitations to how good this technique can be. So this is often called black box testing, because we're treating the program as a black box. We're not looking inside it. We can't see inside what it does. We don't know. We only run it, see if it works, and for memory errors, we aren't even checking the output. We're just seeing if it crashes. But as I said, this finds real bugs. And it isn't that easy to implement in practice, so there's some challenges with making this work well. So one challenge is that to make this work well, you need to actually run the software in a nice controlled environment where you reliably detect crashes. That's not hard, but it's not trivial to do that. And you also need to worry about things like hangs. Like, if the software takes a lot of time, you want to make sure you know whether that's a crash or not, if that randomly happens. Because when you're doing fuzz testing, you're literally going to be running the program billions of times. If there's one in a million thing that might mess up your results, you're going to see it, even if it's something in the system, not in your test case. And you want to deal with that. And since you're running the program millions or billions of times, you also want to make this as fast as possible. So there's some things where fuzz testing isn't so great. Like if you want to fuzz test a program which has a takes 5 seconds to load things, that's not good. You're not going to be able to run it millions of times. You're not going to be able to run a lot of test cases, and that's where fuzz testing is good, is when you can run millions of test cases. Which means that often a thing you'll do when you want to test software, fuzz test software, is you'll take the program and get some minimal piece of it that starts really fast. So if you're testing a word processor, you're not going to start up the whole word processor, you're just going to isolate the thing which loads a document and make that a separate program, for example, most likely. Because that will let you test it lots and lots of times without the overhead of displaying a window on the screen and all that stuff. And the other issue is that while you often can easily find good inputs, sometimes you have to get really lucky to find good inputs. And there's a strategies which let us do better than that, where we can avoid needing to get quite as lucky, where we can give a little extra intelligence. And the main way we're going to do this is by getting rid of this black box assumption. So we're going to stop assuming that we know nothing about what the program does and we know nothing about what type of input it expects. We're going to use a little bit of knowledge of that to get a lot better testing done. Get a lot more out of our millions of tests and hopefully find more of those bugs. And to think about this, so let's start with an example. So let's say we're testing an HTML parser. And let's say I start with a valid HTML document and I just flip random bits. What's usually going to happen? What's the HTML parser usually going to do? Sorry?
Not work.
So not work. What more specifically? How is it not? It's not going to display anything. It's just going to say invalid. Right? So if we flip random bits, we're usually going to say, find out, oh, there wasn't a valid tag there. We're not going to hit many of the interesting cases. So yes, we do want to test the cases where we have invalid tags and things like that, but we don't want that to be all we test. Probably the more interesting bugs in an HTML parser are with some funny HTML documents. Yeah. But when we're testing, we're going to get things like this, right? These are probably all going to hit the same code path. They're going to do the same thing. They're not actually going to test anything new after like the first 10. Like it's all the same stuff in the program. We aren't actually testing any new tags. We aren't testing attributes. You know, we aren't actually finding the interesting cases. So what would be a fix for this? How do we use this sort of strategy but actually hit interesting cases, not just these sort of nothing interesting changes, or we have can you detect syntax errors, simple syntax errors cases? Yeah?
Isolate, we want to randomize a bit more?
Yeah, so one thing we can do is we can say, hey, I don't want to actually change everything. I want to change what the tags are, for example. So we can use some knowledge of what the input format is to decide what our random inputs are. So rather than just making random changes to a base input, the sort of black box strategy, where I have a program and an input that works, I can use my knowledge of HTML to, say, generate random things that look kind of like HTML documents. So I can write something like this, where I get a random tag. I just have a list of all the HTML tags I care about. I just generate things that look like HTML documents, and I use those as my starting points. Maybe I also flip some random bits because I want to detect how syntax errors are handled, but this way at least I'll hit lots of interesting cases, interesting HTML documents, and if there's some bug based on how I nest tags or something like that, I should find it eventually. So this is a common thing that people will do in fuzzing when you have formats where flipping random bits isn't likely to help. That you generate a random document generator as your starting point because you know what the input format is kind of like. Notice here, I don't need to know anything about how the HTML parser works internally. I just need to know this is roughly what HTML looks like. I assume that something similar to what this returns is going to be an interesting test case. And after I get this random HTML, maybe I vary it again a little more with random bit flips to detect, you know, how do you deal with unclosed tags that are syntax errors and things like that. But at least I start with more than just one interesting document, like in my example here, where I had one interesting document and was generating variants of it, which are almost always pretty boring. So another thing that some fuzzing tools do is that, you know, sometimes they'll just take a description of the format and they'll test a single field. And this is what, something that someone mentioned, is that we just isolate what we want to test. So another thing we could have done is we could have say, hey, I want to test all the sorts of things I can put in place of this body. You know, I don't care how the HTML parser deals with the beginning of this. I want to see what happens when I replace that body tag with other various weird things. And we can isolate what we check and therefore hopefully get more useful information. And so there are other tools where, fuzzing tools, where you give a description of what the input format is and say, here's a field that has a value that's like an integer, here's a field that has a value that's like a string of this length. And you give it the description of the format, and it will generate random test cases that comply with that format. So the same sort of random generation idea. And you can do things like say, I'm only going to test this string in isolation, which might be better for finding bugs, assuming that you just change one string at a time, rather than changing one string and something else randomly that messes up your whole document. Other things you can do are you can deal with sort of common things that will make things invalid. So, for example, if you have like sizes or checksums are really bad for fuzzing. If you change, if you have a file format with a checksum to say, did this document get corrupted, and you do fuzzing on it, almost all the time it's going to say, checksum was wrong. That's not good. So you'll want to, one thing people will do in fuzzing is they'll either remove the checksum checking code, or they'll process their fuzzing test cases to fix the checksums. And you can also do this for things like sizes. Like if you add characters in the middle, you can figure out what field is this in, where is the size for it, let's change that size, at least as the default. So these are sort of our generic, simple strategies. And you notice for none of these strategies did I care what the code of the program looked like. And these find lots of bugs. But we can do better if we actually look at the code for the program. Yeah?
How would you go and change back the checksums if you didn't know the code
for the program? You wouldn't know the, so for this you just need to know what the format is. So for example, like PNG files have a checksum, have checksums for certain pieces. So you just recompute it. You'd parse enough of the file to figure out where the checksum should be, or you generate it so you know where the checksum should be, and you just recompute it, recompute the checksum yourself with your own code. Which is easier than parsing the whole file because you're only caring about recomputing the checksum and you don't even care about parsing the rest of the file correctly. And it's really easy if you're generating it from this sort of template. Like you have a description of what a PNG file looks like, you know where you put the data the checksum should be over. You don't actually need to parse it to figure that out. Yeah, but a better solution often is to take the original program and just remove like checksum checking, if you can do that. But you don't always have that luxury. Other questions? Yeah.
Wouldn't it be more efficient to your testing purposes to keep the checksums intact, or when you remove them, you just assume that you're doing it?
When you remove them, so if you're removing the checksum stuff from the code, basically you still have the checksum field there, you just change the thing which says, is this checksum right, to always return true. Which you can be reasonably confident doesn't change the correctness of the program, but it is a concern. Okay, so I'm showing you all these strategies which basically where we don't understand what the program does, and we still generate lots of test cases. And it turns out that if we do this, and our program is like manipulating arrays and has memory bugs, we will often find it. But we can do better. And we can do better by relaxing this restriction of not really knowing what the program does. So as an exercise, here is a bit of C code. Tell me how you would test this. So what would be, like, what are some test cases for this code? This is a function which takes in a string, which is supposed to be null terminated. Okay.
Like, I guess I don't. I mean, they'll all eventually be null terminated.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So the question is, how do I generate good tests for this? So any null terminated string should be a test. How do I generate good ones? Just based on looking at this code. Yeah. Okay, so you're saying, oh, I'm using arg3 here. I'd like to vary that value deliberately. Okay, anything else? Yeah?
You should have cases where you know that arg0 is going to be your bracket, the randomized different part of it, and then you want cases where you know argc will not get into the if statement, randomize other things.
Yeah, so one thing that you do when figuring out how to test your software is you look at things like if statements and say, hey, I want to test this part of it and this part of it. And you want to deliberately make sure arg0 is sometimes a bracket. You know, that's a good idea for testing this function. We definitely want to test arg0 being an open bracket and some things after that. And we also want to test it not being an open bracket. We want to make sure we have both those cases. And after that, we can also do other things, like we want to test varying arg3 because that's an important value here. And so this is a logic that we can apply for generating tests, that we want to look at our code, we want to figure out how can we get our test to run every line of our code. Sort of an intuition you have when testing, that if you're testing your own program and you aren't running part of it, if you aren't using some if statement, then that probably means you aren't actually testing it. And we can apply the same intuition to give us a metric for how good tests are. This is often called coverage. You may have learned about it in an actual software engineering course. It's basically how much of the code is reached. We can also measure how much of like branches are reached. And this has the advantage of being really easy to measure. That given a program, I can just add like counters to different parts of the program and I can measure coverage. And there are tools to do this automatically. And it also has correlation with bugs found. It's not the same thing. You can have 100% coverage and be missing bugs because like values matter, not just what code you run. But it has a correlation with bugs being found. And this is what usually you do manually when writing tests, is try to make sure you're testing every single line of code. And we can apply the same principle for automated test generation. So previously, we're just generating random tests. But if we're willing to look at the program a little more, we can say, why don't we just generate tests that runs all the lines of code? So we just need to look at our code and say, how do I get to this line of code? That seems automatable. You know, our procedure here was we said, okay, there's an if statement here. I know how to get down one half of that if statement. I just need to make arg0 be an open bracket. Then I go down here, oh, I know how to get down there. I need to make arg2 be a dash. And you know, that's very simple reasoning, and it seems like something a computer could do. And there has, in fact, been effort to do this automatically. Now, it's not quite so simple, because often our conditions are not going to be like this, where we can just look at our argument and say, what's the initial value? What's the value going to be exactly? We often don't have that sort of simple condition in real code, especially in a program with like more than one function. Like usually, if we were thinking about this expand function, it would be in a program where it's called from somewhere else, and arg is copied from there. We need to do a bunch of looking at the code to figure out where does that actually come from. Like, what input file byte is it? But there is sort of a systematic procedure for doing this. And the leading technique is something called symbolic execution. So the idea of symbolic execution is that we're going to have a virtual machine. But instead of the virtual machine representing our input as bits, it's going to represent it as a variable. And we're just going to do algebra. So just like in algebra, when you add 2, you just represent that as x plus 2 instead of 2 plus 2, if x is a variable. We're going to do the same thing in our machine, our virtual machine. So we're going to have a virtual machine where we just do operations on these symbolic variables like in algebra. And when we go down a branch, we're going to track what the constraints are that got us there. What did the variables have to equal? And then at the end, we're going to get to this point where we say, OK, here are the values of my variables based on my inputs. So if my input was x, let's say variable A is x plus 3 plus B or something like that. I'm going to have these equations for what my variables are. I'm going to have a list of constraints, like maybe x needed to be greater than 10. And I'm just going to solve the constraints and the equations to find a way of triggering that path down the program. So I'm going to go through an example because you definitely would not have gotten it from that explanation. So here's a simple function. And we're going to show what symbolic execution looks like. So remember, the first step here is that I'm going to represent some values as variables. So in this program, I'm going to represent my two inputs, A and B, as variables. I'm going to write them as alpha and beta to emphasize that they're variables, not concrete values. These are like variables like in algebra. And I'm going to first have this condition, A not equal to 0. And this is going to fork my program. And I'm going to check both ways on this because I want to generate test cases, let's say, for both decisions. I'm going to start by looking at the true case. So in the true case, A is not equal to 0. A is alpha, so alpha isn't equal to 0. So that's something which is a constraint. To get here, alpha not equal to 0 had to be true. And after we do this, we do b minus equals 2, so b is beta minus 2, and alpha plus equals beta, so alpha, so a is a plus equals b, so a is alpha plus beta minus 2. So this makes sense? So we've updated, based on our original symbolic values, what the current values of the variable are. So it's just like executing the code, but we've executed it not by doing the actual integer arithmetic, but by doing algebra, arithmetic. So then we keep going down this code, and we say the next decision we make is b less than 5. So we look at our current value of b, and that's beta minus 2. So if beta minus 2 is less than 5, and a is not equal to 0, we'll end up here. And we know what updates happen there. We know, I'm sorry for the overlap, a is alpha plus beta minus 2, like it was before, and b is beta plus 2, because it gets because of the plus equals 4. So then we can look at our assert statement here, and we can try to solve this system of equations. Let's say a plus b, that's alpha plus 2 beta, equals 5, not 17. So alpha plus beta equals 5, and we have a solution to that. So as long as we have a way of solving a system of equations, we can generate a test case which goes down this path and triggers this assertion. This makes sense? Questions? And people look a bit confused because I suspect. So the key idea is that we're emulating the program, but we're replacing some parts of the program with symbolic variables, things just where we do algebra And when we went to actually figure out how to turn this into something concrete, we went to generate this 5 and 0, we do that by just solving the equations we have. We have constraints for the various if statements and other things that we encountered on our path, and we have the values of the variables, which are just formulas that we update based on how the variables are updated. Yeah? Yes, so the question is, from the A0 equals 0 path, we had a path on this side here for the true case. Is there also one equivalent for the false case? And the answer is yes. So we're going to have paths for every single conditional. And if you want to generate all your test cases and see, generate thorough test cases for this program, we're going to check every single one of these paths. Yeah.
This is one place where the branches might diverge, this is another place, that type of thing?
So the question is, what's the interface for these tools look like? So generally, the way the interface will look is that you'll say, this variable is something I want you to be make a symbolic variable. So you'll say, I want to make A and B symbolic, and the tool will figure out the rest. And I'm not going to explain too much detail how the tools work, yeah. So.
Would this only work for like programming languages like Java and C++?
So the question is, does this only work for programming languages like Java and C++? So it turns out that you can do this on assembly. So you can make it work for anything. Implementation is not trivial.
Why is it alpha plus 2 beta? Is it supposed to be alpha plus 2 beta equals 5?
Yeah, it's alpha plus 2 beta equals 5, not 17. Which is, that's because that's alpha plus beta minus 2 plus beta minus 2, beta plus 2. Yeah.
What happens if there's like a library function call or something that doesn't have to, that it can't analyze correctly what the results are?
So the question is, what do we do if we had, b plus equals some library call? In that case, these tools don't work. If it's plus equals a library call, these tools do work if it's like plus equals a library call, because we just get the result of that library call and use it. But if we're passing A and B to the library call, we're out of luck. We have no way of doing that. So there are various choices for that. So one thing you could do, if you have that situation, you're writing this tool, is you can generate a possible A and B when you make that library call and use it. At least in that case, you're testing something. But you're not going to be able to have the full power of this technique. Okay. Other questions about symbolic execution? Okay. So this is a very general technique, but it has some issues. So one issue is that I just said we generate the system of equations and we solve it. That is actually very hard. So at least we're generating a bounded formula because we have only so many bits of input. So there's always a solution. We can just try all possible bits of input until one works. So we can definitely solve these equations, but it's NP-hard. So if you've taken computability, you know that that's bad. It basically means it's not generally possible. The lucky thing is that people in sort of the AI area have come up with solvers that are good enough for sufficiently small programs if you have lots of additional heuristics. But it's not actually generally possible, and in some programs you're not going to be able to do it. Just because solving arbitrary equations is not actually, something you can generally do. So that's one issue. The other issue is how many paths. So we saw in this simple program here, we have 8 paths. And this gets really bad really fast. So if we have a loop, how many paths is that? could easily have thousands, millions, hundreds, tens of thousands of paths with a small amount of input. How do we deal with array accesses? Well, the easiest way is to generate a path for each element you could be accessing and split up that way. That is not very, very friendly for performance. And you also need to make sure you eliminate impossible paths. You'll sometimes generate a path where you'll find out, if when you solve things, that, oh, there's no possible value of any of the inputs to get here. But you want to make sure that happens quickly. But in general, there's such a huge number of paths, and practice tools which do this need to prioritize. And probably real programs often only explore a subset of paths. But it's pretty good. It's not like fuzz testing. You're actually going to get a lot of different paths through the program, which is not guaranteed with random testing. So I showed you this technique for generating sort of different test cases. So you could also use this to more directly check for memory errors. So if you just insert a bounds check, let's say, then you just generate the constraints and you solve the equation. So the same technique which let us generate an input, we can use it directly to test for out of bounds errors by just adding the bounds check to the program and executing this as part of our symbolic execution. Okay, so any questions about sort of this application? This is actually a fairly simple application once we know the technique. We just make sure there's a branch to check for, is there a crash? Should there be a crash, I should say. So as I hinted, there's some real practical challenge with this. So this is not yet used that much outside of research, just a little bit of use. And it's actually a really old technique, because the main challenge to making it work is just that the equation solving and the pathfinding is not the conceptual idea, it's making it work on real programs with non-trivial sizes. So it dates back to the 70s, but back in the 70s, solving even a simple program enough to generate the test cases was not practical. But there are real research software you can use which does this. So one example is a tool called CLI, which if you compile a program appropriately, it will generate test cases for it. You just run it on the program, you say, I want to have this many bytes of input, which is represented by variables, and it will generate a test case for each path through the program based on that many bytes of variable input. And this is unlike fuzz testing. You might test all those possibilities, but this will guarantee you that if you give it enough time, it's going to generate all the possible tests that could be hit by an input of that length, all the possible cases. And the authors of CLI, not surprisingly, when they ran this on some real software, they found lots of memory bugs, even in software which was pretty well tested. So I've told you basically that this is this neat technique, which is basically what you do by hand to generate test cases when you want to cover all the code, but you can't really use it because it's kind of research software, it only works on small enough programs, it relies on equation solvers which don't really work, but there's a compromise. And that's going to be sort of a combination of these two techniques we talked about. So the symbolic execution technique was sort of based on, I want to go down this path in the program, how do I do that? And the fuzz testing technique was based on, I just want to generate some interesting input, how do I do that? So we're going to do both. So we're going to generate random test cases based on existing good test cases, and we're going to look at what code actually gets run. So let me start with an expanded version of our previous example. So I've marked the blocks of code with letters here. And we could measure with a simple compiler tool when each of these things are reached. We could just increment a counter and see what a test case does. So we would know, for example, if we supply this A and B, that we reach X and z, and that's it. Reach w and z. Wow, okay, as you'll see. And we can generate random tests by changing something slightly in that until we cover something different. Sorry, that should be W and Z, just like all these cases. I missed one. So we generate it until we generate something which covers something different. Okay, so far this is exactly the same as fuzz testing. We haven't changed anything. So we're going to be different is after we find a new test case, we're going to add it to our set of basic test cases. And then we're going to generate new test cases based on those. And the idea of this is that this is going to hopefully find us an interesting test case for every path through the program, as long as we can eventually hit it with random testing. And it's going to let us do things like get to cases like here, which we might not get to with random testing very easily. So we can get to this Q here, because we will eventually get to the Y at least, and that will help us get to Q. But if we were starting from our initial test case, which didn't get to Y, we would never really get there. So this idea makes sense. So we're going to start with some test case, and we're going to look at what it covers. And we're going to make new random tests based on that until we cover a little more of the program. And we're going to assume that we can tweak that new test case to cover things which are related to that. And the idea is that by starting up test cases which run different parts of the program, we're going to eventually have full coverage. So just like in symbolic execution, but we're not going to solve anything, we're just going to try random things that are going to hit slightly different paths. And our intuition is that by taking a test case that goes down one path and making little changes, we'll go down related paths. This is not guaranteed, certainly, but it works most of the time in practice. So if you think of like a file format, if the beginning of the file is right, changing things later on, it's probably going to tweak where else you go in the program, but you'll have the same first part of the program. And you want to start at the right sorts, different sorts of starting places for different paths through like header parsing or something like that. Yeah?
So with the initial test case, do you choose something that's unlikely to happen, or do you choose a very common case?
So the question is, what do we choose for initial test cases? So there's lots of choices. So usually you want to choose something that's interesting. So a common thing would be like with an image parser, you take a small valid image as your initial test case. You don't want to take like an invalid image because that will like exit the parser immediately. You want something which runs a lot of code, which has good coverage to start out with, because that should be a good starting place for hitting all the code you haven't found yet. But you don't need to actually explore deeply for the strange cases because random testing should do that. Okay. So after our ROP assignment, we're going to be using a tool called American Fuzzy Lopin Assignment, which is a fuzzer which works on this strategy. It's a coverage-based fuzzer. So it uses this strategy of taking some base test cases, making some random changes to them, and seeing if that runs different code. And if it does, it adds that to the set of base test cases, then generates new test cases based on all the unique test cases it collected, and sees if that runs different code again and repeats. Yeah?
So you can just go like testing code normally, right? Like isn't to like protect against an attacker?
Yeah, so these are just for testing code normally. So the reason they're particularly attractive for finding security problems is that when finding security problems, our notion of is this code correct is basically does it crash. That is easy to test. You can also use these tools to test sort of more interesting types of correctness, but it's a lot more work. If I'm testing an image parser and I'm generating random inputs, I need some way of knowing is it parsing the image correctly. That's not actually easy to do. I would need like a second implementation of the image parser to check against. People have done this, but it's not actually so useful for more generic software testing, just because you need to have truth about what should the output be. And here we're generally not actually checking the output. All we care about is, does it crash? Okay. Other questions? So, yeah, so in our assignment after ROP, we're going to be using American Fuzzy Lop. So it's this, what it calls itself, a white box fuzzing tool, because unlike the black box we had before, we actually look inside the software. And what it does is it has an assembler wrapper, which basically on every conditional jump inserts this array update. And it looks at what's in that array. So it's the same idea of looking at what parts of the code get run, and it uses this to find new test cases that run new code. And it outputs for you all the quote-unquote unique test cases. Unique in this case means it covers the same stuff. And its goal is if you run it long enough, it's supposed to find test cases which hit every possible jump you can have in your program. Every possible way an if statement could go, every possible way a switch statement could go, every possible way a function call through a function pointer could go, and so on. And it's based on the central idea of that we're going to try to start with test cases which cover as much as possible in order to generate new test cases. But that's where it starts, but otherwise it's mostly random. Just generate random variations and hope we hit some new code. So it has a bit of heuristics for that, and this is something you'll see, you know, commonly in software of this sort. So first of all, I said it's random, it actually does some deterministic testing. There's deterministic testing that makes sense. So like it tries flipping every bit of its base test cases and every two bits. It tries overwriting every byte of its base test cases with all ones or all zeros. And a whole bunch of other things. And so I showed you the random strategy of like taking a byte, flipping some random bits in the byte by XORing with a random number. So this tool does that, but it also does some other things to generate new test cases. So one thing it does is it tries to duplicate words in the test input. Or it also takes two test inputs and tries to combine them, like take first half of one, the second half of the other. So these are heuristics. There's no guarantee they'll do anything interesting, but for many real programs, they produce new interesting inputs. And you can try them in a randomized way. You randomly choose what part of each two test cases to combine. You randomly choose what part of a test case to copy to another part to duplicate what might be a keyword, and so on. So questions about these sorts of heuristic strategies? Yeah. So the hope is just that these strategies find us new code coverage. So another thing that this strategy can do, which is useful for dealing with test cases, is that once we get a test case that crashes, what do we do? What can you do with that crashing test case? And the logical thing is you just take out the debugger and start figuring out what happens. But you know, this test case might be pretty complicated. Can we make that better? And there are things we can do to simplify test cases. And this is another thing American Fuzzy Lop, the tool we're using, does. So because we know about coverage, we can try making changes to a test case, and instead of trying to find new code to run, we can try to keep running the same code. So we can like see, how many, can I remove this character and run the same code? And things like that. So we can keep trying to simplify a test case by removing characters, by setting characters to the same value to make it simpler. And this is something American Fuzzy Lop has a tool to do. So you give it a crashing test case, and it produces the simplest version of it it can find. Like it doesn't have any extraneous characters or other inputs. It has all the smallest values it can use. And they can just do this by making a little change, see if it covers the same code. And it also does this as part of a strategy to produce base test cases. Because one thing that's bad in fuzzing is when you have, like in our HTML example, lots of stuff that you could change that doesn't really matter. And this is a way that you can avoid that, is by simplifying the test case to have as little stuff that doesn't matter as possible. And you can actually do this automatically. This is another heuristic that that tool that AFL does. Okay, so any questions about? So, next time. Okay, so as I mentioned earlier, like, we're talking about fuzzing tools because these are great for finding crashes. And most crashes, probably, or often a security bug. So people who find security bugs in practice, this is often what they do, especially if they're starting with some big piece of software like a web browser. Like, you aren't going to read the code for a web browser to figure out where might there be a use after free bug. You're going to try some random stuff and see if it triggers a segfault. You can also use this for more traditional testing. So one example from the literature is that people famously have used this to test C compilers. And that was a good example because they could generate a random C program, and they test it on one compiler versus some other compilers and see if they agree. And if they don't agree, you probably have a bug. And so there's a 2011 paper which did this, and they found 79 bugs in GCC, 209 bugs in Clang. And about one third of them were bugs where the compiler didn't crash, but just generated the wrong code, which did the wrong thing. So you can use this for other things, but we're talking about it for security because it's really good for finding crashes. And we'll have an assignment where you're going to take some buggy software and find here's a way of making it crash, which is probably a buffer overflow. Okay, that's what I have for today.